From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The shooting of a 32-year-old African-American father of three in Kenosha, Wisconsin, has become the latest flashpoint in the fight against racist police violence. Video shows Jacob Blake shot in the back at nearly point-blank range by an officer who's now been identified as Rustin Chesky. Blake remains paralyzed from the waist down. Already, Kenosha police are claiming that he had been reaching for a knife in his car when police shot him. It's a familiar script for those sickened by an ongoing epidemic of killings of Black Americans, for whom justice is not only elusive, but who are often blamed for the violence that police wreak on them. Can police be held accountable? My guest is Christopher E. Brown, an attorney and expert on excessive police force cases and qualified immunity. He runs the historic African-American law firm, the Brown Firm. He recently won a $3.5 million settlement for the family of Wayne Jones, a mentally ill man who was shot 22 times by West Virginia police. Welcome to the program, Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much, Sonali, for having me.
Before we talk about the case that you worked on in the settlement, let's talk about the issue that's in the papers, that's being covered, that is generating protests all around the country, and that's the shooting of Jacob Blake. It's not often in the past that we've had video of these incidents of police violence, but now that there's more and more documentary evidence, videos of these actual shootings, they seem to lend more credence to the claims that police are unfairly shooting African-Americans. And the case of Jacob Blake seems to fit that. When people watch that video, it is quite shocking. It does not seem to be a justified shooting at all.
Yeah, I think it was Will Smith who said, it's not getting worse, it's getting videoed. And so we have a situation where, as in my case, when you have video, it kind of changes the game. Now, rest assured, Mr. Blake's case is not going to be easy. I can tell you right now, if I'm arguing on behalf of those officers and I have this doctrine of qualified immunity on my side, I'm arguing that the officer was in fear for his own safety or safety of others, that Mr. Blake was reaching for a weapon, gun, taser, knife, whatever they say it was, but they didn't know what it was at the time. And for fear that he may reach in and grab a weapon and harm them, they took action. Now, it'll be an interesting argument to see his counsel say, well, you could have used non-lethal force. And this is where we get into problems with training, et cetera, with the departments. But nonetheless, on his face, this appears to be another tragic instance of violence against an African-American male by police who was engaging in a brutal use of excessive force.
So you have multiple officers, you have one man. What we know so far from media reports is that Mr. Blake might have been trying to break up a fight. And of course, often in these cases, it is the victim who ends up being on trial. Immediately, you hear defenders of police question why he didn't just submit to the police, maybe bring up any past records, criminal records that the victims or targets of police shooting might have had. And it's remarkable to see the same script play out. But that's a pretty normal thing, right? That the people who are shot, even if they've not been found guilty of anything by a court, their shootings continue to be justified by the supporters of police.
It's reminiscent of a rape case, right? With a female victim. And the factors that go into whether or not the use of force was justified are called the Graham factors. And what behavior was the suspect engaged in at the time? Was he engaged in the commission of a crime? Was that a misdemeanor or a felony? Was he fleeing police? Was he refusing commands to, you know, stop? It shouldn't really go into some of the other issues that get brought up. But like you mentioned before, this is sort of the all familiar tale. This is the new, you know, I smelled marijuana in the car of the excessive force world. As soon as the officers can make some representation that there was some behavior that caused them to be in fear for their own safety or the safety of others, they then use that as a defense to have engaged in the use of lethal force when there are certainly other options available.
So when this case goes to court, What do you expect the defense to be? You alluded to it earlier. What's the familiar script that's going to be unrolled to defend these police actions that, at least, you know, from viewers who are watching it, just seem uncalled for?
Yeah, it's, you know, watching the video, you know, I can already tell you what it's going to be. And I wouldn't have a hard time making it. There are counter arguments that can be raised. The problem is the way the doctrine of qualified immunity has been expanded over the years by the courts that really relieve officers of any liability for anything but the most egregious actions. So, you know, I don't have a problem with qualified immunity as a doctrine in and of itself. It's the way the courts are sort of employing it and applying it to these cases.
And let's step back, if you can explain to a lay audience what qualified immunity is.
Well, the federal statute, 1983, 42 USC section 1983, one of the civil rights statutes, says that if a state actor violates your rights, you can bring a claim for damages. And the courts have sort of created and imposed the doctrine of qualified immunity, which is an issue in and of itself. I mean, really, Congress didn't write it into the statute, but the courts have said, well, you must have meant that there are some instances where state actors can't be sued. So we're going to implement this doctrine called qualified immunity. It's not full immunity. It's partial immunity for any actions that are but the most egregious. In other words, you can't sue state actors, police officers, for the most part. For negligence. You know, you and I can be sued if we make a mistake in an accident and our car bumps into somebody else or we have an injury that's caused by our negligence. State actors is not the case. Now, so when police officers make mistakes, they cannot be sued for that. It almost needs to be purposeful and intentional and malicious if you want to be confident you're going to survive the qualified immunity doctrine defense.
And that involves getting inside the mind of a police officer, which unless they're saying exactly what they're thinking, there's no way to know.
And the test is tough when it says, you know, we want to determine whether or not any reasonable officer would have known he was violating Mr. Blake's rights when he shot him, when he thought Mr. Blake was reaching for a weapon. And the problem with that test and the way it's worded is if you line 10 officers up and 9 of them raise their hand and say, yes, I would have known I was violating his rights. As long as one officer does not raise his hand, that officer will be allowed to employ the doctrine of qualified immunity.
Wow. So tell me about the case of Wayne Jones. This, I mentioned, was a man who was shot by police in West Virginia, and you just recently won a pretty large settlement for his family. What happened to him, and how did the issue of qualified immunity get raised in his shooting?
Mr. Jones, in Martinsburg, West Virginia, was walking next to the sidewalk as opposed to on the sidewalk. And apparently, there was an ordinance that said you're required to walk on the sidewalk. You can see the dash cam of the first officer following Mr. Jones, you know, very slowly as he walked for a few minutes. And then he pulls around in front of him, stops the car and gets out. Hey, what are you doing? And Mr. Jones, you know, is, why are you bothering me? What, did I do something wrong? And then the officer starts asking him questions. And asked him, do you have a weapon on you? And he says, yeah, well, what do you mean by a weapon? Club, guns, knives. And Mr. Jones says, yeah, I may have something on me. He had scissors on him. And the officer asked him to put his hands on the car. And at that point, Mr. Jones correctly asked, why are you asking me to do this? I mean, there's nothing illegal about having a knife on you. There's nothing illegal about having a gun on you if you have a license for it. And Mr. Jones refused to comply with commands to put his hands on the car. The officer began to physically assault him. And Mr. Jones attempted to run off. The officer tased him, and Mr. Jones ran. He was pursued by that officer. A second officer joined that pursuit. They sort of trapped him in this corner stairwell. They approached him, gave him what they call a brachial attack in the throat. Grabbed him, threw him to the ground, got him in a chokehold. He was in that chokehold for 17 seconds. You can hear him grunting. You can hear objects striking him with blunt force on the video. Two other officers arrive, and then a fifth officer arrives. And as they have five trained officers, grown men, holding down a 50-year-old, 162-pound man who's been in a chokehold for 17 seconds and tased three times at this point. One of them yells, "He's got a knife." And you hear an officer say, "Where's the knife?" He says, "It's in his hand." And one of the officers yells, "Back up, back up, back up." And they all back up and they start saying, "Drop the knife, drop the knife." And you hear one of the officers yell, "Shoot that MF," right? Before they even asked him to drop the knife. And when he does not respond for about 5 or 6 seconds to those commands, where they backed up and created a semicircle around him about 5 feet away, they shot him 22 times and killed him.
Wow. So many, many aspects of what you just described, we've seen in many different cases around the country, the chokeholds, the claims of a knife, the tasing, you know, and it seems as though just trying to get away from police who have accosted you for no reason is enough of a crime in America today that if you're a Black person in particular, you pay the price, the ultimate price for it, you are shot. And often these instances start out slow and then escalate rapidly. And when people act out of natural fear, that fear is somehow interpreted as a crime. People are shot. It escalates so fast. So I imagine they brought up the issue of qualified immunity in this case as well. How did you as an attorney tackle that?
Let me preface that by saying there was a very difficult hurdle to overcome, which was I did not handle the initial litigation before the district court in West Virginia. And that lawyer had an issue where he responded to what we call requests for admissions, like 3 days late, which in one with a litigation background like myself, that is inconsequential. But under the rules, that was late, which meant those requests for facts to be admitted were deemed admitted. And those facts were that Mr. Jones had a knife, that Mr. Jones tried to stab an officer, and that Mr. Jones refused commands to drop the knife. And of course, based on that, it comes as no surprise that was an easy out for the district court to dismiss the case. It was then that I came into the case on the first appeal, and we got the judge overturned for the first dismissal. And the way these cases go, there are prongs in the test. And so we go back to the district court, and the judge, "Well, I'm going to reach this next prong. I'm going to dismiss it on that ground." And I appealed that. And then the third ground, after the two prongs of the test were resolved in the first two appeals, the third ground, it got went back to the district court after the second appeal was successful, and she held, "Well, I haven't gotten to the issue of qualified immunity yet. I'm going to reach that issue now, and I'm dismissing the case again." How did I overcome it? In light of those admissions and the onerous nature of the doctrine itself, I overcame it by examining the video and applying what there is clear case law about, which is once a suspect is subdued, there is no authority or right to use excessive force at that point, which makes sense, right? And I made an argument to the Fourth Circuit that when you had five grown men, trained officers, holding this man down, I don't care what he had in his hand, he's subdued at that point. And they let him go, backed up 5 feet away from him. He appears motionless and unconscious on the video at this point, by the way, yell at him for 5 seconds to drop a knife and shoot him and kill him. And I made the argument that would create a perverse incentive where officers who had a subject detained could then release that subject to justify shooting them. You know, the doctrine is difficult in that it seems to allow officers to get away with behavior that you or I would look at and say, "Well, obviously you can't do that." You know, was the violation of the constitutional right clearly established, which is the second prong of the test, which is tough. Has there been a situation like this before so that this officer would have known he or she couldn't do this? And yet you have these situations where a layperson can look and say, "That's obvious." But yet the court will look at it and say, "Well, we haven't quite had a case like this yet. So the constitutional right wasn't clearly established. He says he was in fear for his safety. So we're going to grant qualified immunity." And that's what happened. That's what the district court did in the Jones case. And the Fourth Circuit accepted my argument and their opinion reflected it, that he was subdued. At that time, they had no right to engage in the use of excessive force, and backing away from him to then shoot him did not change that. Right. They are actually putting themselves in danger by releasing him and backing away. And again, I urge the court to avoid the perverse incentive that the case would establish, that if you have a suspect detained who's a threat, you have him under your control, you can then release that person and shoot them because of what happened before you had them detained. And I was very pleased with the result.
How often have courts allowed qualified immunity to be overturned, allowed police to be, you know, to actually be held accountable in this way? And actually, I should ask you, was there accountability beyond a financial settlement? Did anybody go to prison?
Okay, two good questions. I'll take the second part first. Mm-hmm. West Virginia is unique. They have a very interesting statute that allows an individual to request a second grand jury proceeding if you can make the case that the first proceeding was tainted in the way it was presented, which is a whole other discussion. The way the prosecutors who present these cases to the grand jury are the ones who work with these officers every day in court on traffic cases and misdemeanors, et cetera. So we filed that in state court, and that is still pending. Now, let's be clear. The grand jury did not indict the officers after the shooting. I feel it was probably very easy to go in and say he had a knife and tried to stab an officer, you know, and they didn't indict. But we filed the action to reconvene the grand jury. So there's still a chance. That action was not part of the settlement agreement. So we settled all the civil claims for monetary damages. But the action to reconvene the grand jury, which is before the West Virginia Supreme Court right now, is allowed to go forward. And we're hopeful that that court will agree that we made the case that we should be entitled to the transcripts of the grand jury proceeding, make a case that it was presented in a skewed manner, and proceed to criminally indict the officers, who all still work for the department, by the way. Wow. One of them retired. The other four still work.
This was an incident that happened several years ago. This is not, I mean, these things take years to wend their way through courts.
Yeah. Anyone who, you know, sometimes potential clients or families will call and they'll say, oh, this one's going to settle fast. There's no way they want this to get out. No, no. They fight these things. They fight them vehemently. They fight them with everything they've got. They don't want anybody to ever feel that suing a municipality for the actions of an officer is going to be easy. So even in Mr. Blake's case, they're going to fight for it. It's going to take a while. They got to overcome qualified immunity. If they don't, they'll be in the appellate courts hoping for the best. Which brings me to your first question, which is how often do the appellate courts overturn a district court's grant of qualified immunity? And the answer is not often. I think right. I could probably count on
and
two hands.
And we know
hands.
That it was, I think, fairly recently that the U.S. Supreme Court left, you know, they could have overturned the, or at least restricted qualified immunity for police. They didn't do it in spite of the fact that there's such a massive uprising around the nation. Americans are fed up of the impunity that they see police acting with. And so is this the sort of thing that you as an attorney hope the, you know, a future Supreme Court could take up again, or that needs to be legislated by Congress, that police ought to be held to the same, if not higher, standards when it comes to, you know, they're armed and they're supposed to be protecting us. So when it comes to carrying out their duties in the course of protecting us, if they're not being held to high standards, there is violence that is unleashed, and it's really tearing America apart. You hope that this does get tackled on a broad level rather than case by case.
It has to be. And that is one of my biggest criticisms of how the Supreme Court and the majority of the district courts around the country employ this doctrine. The problem is, you know, qualified immunity applies to all state actors. It applies to teachers and the trash, you know, everybody. Anybody who's paid and an employee of the state, the government, the county, is a state actor. And it can be strange that when we're dealing with police officers, the courts treat the officers with these kid gloves. Like these are trained men and women in the use of force. trained in the use of lethal force, non-lethal force, trained in detaining suspects, trained in the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. They're trained on these issues, yet they're handled with such kid gloves when these issues come up that they seem to be treated like, well, we can't expect them to have known that. You know, that hasn't occurred before. I mean, there's a case from the Supreme Court, Casella v. Hughes, where this woman, there was a complaint of this woman acting irrationally with a knife in her yard. Three police officers show up. She's standing in her yard next to her roommate. There's a fence between the officers and the woman. The two officers say, we didn't have a problem. We were going to wait and see if she was going to talk to us. The other officer waited like 4 seconds and shot her three times. Now, the court ended up holding, the Supreme Court of the United States, that the right wasn't clearly established because the roommate was within reach and could have been injured. And the officer said he was scared that she might injure the woman standing next to her. But yet she made no furtive movements, no strange aggressive behavior. And I'm looking at him thinking, you can't just open fire on people. But he got away with it because this doctrine allows it and doesn't treat him like a trained police officer, like you just said.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Christopher, for joining us today. We'll see how these issues play out in the future. Good luck to you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Christopher E. Brown. He's an attorney and an expert on excessive police force cases and qualified immunity. He runs the law firm, the Brown Firm. He recently won a $3.5 million settlement for the family of Wayne Jones, a man who was shot 22 times by West Virginia police. We've also been discussing, of course, the case in the news this week, and that is the Jacob Blake shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.